give Ways and Means to order. There we go. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 5018. Paul, would you like to update us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at your places you have three handouts. The first is the schedule for next week. You'll see that Monday we'll be finishing up with the Department of Environmental Quality, hearing some on their fee ratification bill, and then having public testimony on their budget bill. Then the balance of the week will be dealing with the Water Resources Department budget. The second handout you have is concerning privatization of the VIP program. You have a memorandum from representatives for the for ESP and some response to some of the testimony that you heard yesterday about privatization. And the third handout is from the Department of Environmental Quality, and this is some responses to the questions that were raised during yesterday's hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Stephanie, would you like to come forth and maybe run through the handout much for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. We have a brief handout for you from yesterday. There was a question from the chair with regard to the prospective purchaser agreements and whether or not we could make some adjustment to statute, rule, or policy that would take into consideration some sites where it isn't, where we might be concerned about potential contamination rather than having necessarily ascertained that there is contamination. We're in the process of looking now to see whether or not a statute change is necessary. If it is, we'll get back to you no later than the middle of next week for your assistance on that.
Yes, thank you.
Also, a request was made for some information about fund balances, and Paul has given us some additional detail on that, and we're working on putting that summary together for you, and we'll get that back to Paul next week. Representative Krieger had asked about retirements, and we've given you a little table here that, as you can see, shows a blip in 2002 when the discussions about PERS started. To date, we've only had four firm announcements in 2003, but we are expecting there could be more. You heard yesterday the number that are eligible. We are still working on the request you made, I believe, on Monday with regard to the comparison about stringency, and we've talked to the Environmental Council of the States. It's taking a fair amount of research to get that answer back to you, but we'll be back on Monday on that question as well.
Okay. Thank you. Stephanie, of those who have retired since 2000, have you hired any of them back as part-time personnel?
No. I'm going to ask Holly Schroeder to come answer that because I don't know whether we have or not.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Holly Schroeder. I work in the budget office at DEQ. We have had, I believe we have four employees back as temporary employees for a combination of reasons. Some are to train replacements, and others are to just do some completion of some small projects. They are brought back as temporary employees, so they fall into the requirements of the temporary rules set by DAS.
Do you know how long they'll be there?
Which means they will be there less than 6 months.
Now, is that a requirement of 6 months per year, or is that the department's policy that in 6 months they'll be gone for permit?
Mr. Chair, the department's policy is consistent with the policy of the Department of Administrative Services, which is, I believe, 6 months per year. I think Ms. Pearson is looking that up.
We don't, Mr. Chairman, we do not have a policy that's any different than DAS.
Mr. Chair, Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services. ORS 240.309 says temporary employees for the same workload need, other than leave, may not exceed 6 calendar months. And employment of a temporary employee for different workload needs shall not exceed the equivalent of 6 calendar months and 12 calendar days.
questions, the committee?
Chairman Krieger. Is there a difference between a temp and the limited duration?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, yes, a temp isn't actually established in the position information control system. You could go through, do they still call it Kelly? Manpower, that kind of thing, or use state temps, which would be in a pool. Limited durations, you actually have a position authorized and established in the system, and it goes away after 2 years.
2 years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We're ready to move on, I guess.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd ask Michael Willen, the administrator of the Water Quality Program, to join me at the table. We left off yesterday. We were just going to begin the discussion of the policy packages in the Water Quality Program, which would be page 27 of the handout that I had provided when I started my testimony. And if there are no questions on what Mike presented yesterday, we'll just start ahead with, I think he's going to start with package 1.4.
Okay, for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike Llewellyn, Administrator of the Water Quality Division. I'm going to start with package number 120, which is the Willamette Basin TMDL package. Before I do, Mr. Chair, you had asked, I believe on Monday, when Stephanie passed out the map of the TMDL schedule, how the what criteria were used in 1997 to establish that original schedule. It's actually a number of things that were used at the time. First of which was we were still operating under a consent decree that was signed in the mid-1980s that established a schedule for completion of TMDLs, and we still had some of the TMDLs remaining from that consent decree to finish. So those went to the top of the list. The Klamath Basin would be an example of one that was in that original consent decree. The second tier of criteria had to do with the listings of endangered species, the thought being if we, under the Oregon plan, which is where this whole schedule was originally developed, if we started to focus on the basins in the state that had endangered species and get those basins done, it would help with eventually the delisting process. The third was obviously just workload in terms of allocating of our resources across the state to balance what we could do with the positions that we had to do the TMDL program. So that really is the nature of the schedule. Since then, in the 97 session, the legislature gave the agency FTEs to accelerate the schedule for 9 of the 12 sub-basins in the Willamette, which will relate to this package that I'm about to talk to you. The theory there being that if we got into a situation where we put ourselves on a schedule and we started working on a TMDL and then somebody wanted us to go work somewhere else, we would, you know, just leave a lot of work behind. And so we wanted to stick pretty firm to the schedule. So anytime we've gotten requests to accelerate a basin, we've always done that through new resources. Another example is the Brownlee Reservoir on the Snake System. It's very important to get the TMDL done there because the Idaho Power Company is going through their relicensing of that hydropower facility. The state of Idaho also was under a settlement agreement schedule from their litigation on TMDLs, and they had that basin moved way up in their schedule compared to ours. So we had a disconnect between the two states. So Idaho Power provided what we call receipts authority money for us to accelerate our TMDL schedule, which didn't impact moving our resources from other parts of the state. We basically hired staff using their authority, receipts authority.
Could you bring us on up through the time frame up to present, including the non-point source again? I know we touched on that when Director gave the first initial report this week, but could you tie it all together for me at least?
In terms of where we are on our schedule?
Yes, how that's laid out, the time frame that
sure.
And got us to where we are today.
Well, Stephanie passed out this map on Monday, and that continues to be the schedule that we've been operating under since 1997 to get us through the year 2007, at which point all of the water bodies that were on the 1996 and then the 1998 303D list would have TMDLs done for them. You may notice that in some cases we are behind. If you look at the Wallawa as an example, that's a basin that was originally due in 2000, but we're behind schedule there. The Umpqua system as well, we're behind schedule there. That was primarily because, very much like the Idaho Power situation, there's a very large hydropower regime on the Umpqua system that got in the middle of a 401 recertification process that put us behind on the TMDL side. So if you look at the schedule per se, you'll see that we are, in some basins, behind in terms of the Oregon plan. But the consent decree that we're operating under, which is on the legal side of the issue, we're actually ahead of schedule because the consent decree that EPA entered into with the plaintiffs did not lock in, essentially, basin by basin on this Oregon plan schedule. Instead, it just said do a certain number of TMDLs by a date certain. You also, I think, asked the question, Mr. Chair, on Monday about did the consent decree dictate essentially which basins we had to do, and the answer was absolutely not. That was one of our primary concerns when we got in the middle of the negotiation on that litigation, is we wanted to maintain the flexibility in Oregon to do TMDLs where we wanted to do them in terms of sequence. So the consent decree simply established a numeric threshold that we had to meet in terms of the number of TMDLs we have to do. So we're ahead of that schedule, in essence, so the consent decree wouldn't be triggered. That said, obviously, one of the concerns that we have now is we've lost seven positions as a result of the numerous special sessions in the TMDL program. As you know, we have the uncertainty of the Haas decision and how that might play out in the long run. That Haas decision will not change the nature of EPA looking at how TMDLs are defined or what needs to be done. So if the state falls behind, either because of the loss of FTEs and our inability to stay on schedule or because of state litigation, we are at risk of not meeting the consent decree numbers eventually. We're not in that case today, but if you extrapolate out, we could certainly be in that situation.
So is the non-point bound to the consent decree as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the consent decree talks about TMDLs as we know them, which is you do TMDLs for water bodies that are not meeting standards, regardless of the source. If it's all point source, you do them. If it's a mixture of point and non-point source problems, you do them. And if it's just non-point source only, you do them. That's the federal regulation today. That's obviously what's being challenged here in Oregon. But the consent decree does not make a distinction in terms of not doing TMDLs if the only source is non-point source only. So if we don't do them, in other words, here in Oregon, then EPA will do them.
And that's the judge's decision is being appealed now, but even if the judge's decision holds, that won't change that?
Well, I'm not an attorney, Mr. Chair, but if I extrapolate out what I think could happen, we may be prohibited as a state from doing TMDLs for non-point source only streams if that's the case law here in Oregon. It does not change. As a matter of fact, it would be contrary to case law here in the Ninth Circuit, which ruled just the opposite of the Haas decision, which says the Clean Water Act does require TMDLs to be done for non-point source only streams. So EPA would step in and do those TMDLs for the state of Oregon if that plays out legally.
Yes. Interesting.
May I ask a follow-up?
Representative Morgan.
Do you have any kind of communication from EPA indicating that that'll be the outcome?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, not an official correspondence. They're very well aware of the case, obviously. But again, on a national perspective, EPA has been requiring TMDLs for non-point source only streams nationally. Again, the Ninth Circuit ruled in the so-called Pronsolino case, a similar case in California that challenged EPA's authority to require non-point source only TMDLs to be done. The Ninth Circuit ruled that EPA does have the authority to do that.
When was that?
I believe that was about 2 years ago, Representative Morgan. That, by the way, that Pronsolino case is being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the whole underpinning of this issue of non-point source only TMDLs is at play in the legal realm.
So what DEQ is proposing to do then is to appeal the result of the Oregon lawsuit?
That's correct, Representative Martin.
What kind of cost does that carry?
In terms of the cost of legal, I don't know. I know that the plaintiffs have already filed for attorney's fees for the first round of the litigation. I believe it was on the order of $130,000 to the state. The Department of Justice is appealing that or challenging that amount of money. But obviously, the further this goes in the legal system, the state will incur costs in terms of the defense of this case.
It would seem, though, that you would have to have some kind of estimates of what you think this is going to require if you're going to do this to fold it into your budget request for Attorney General money. If we could find that out. I think it would be interesting for this committee to know how much that would reasonably be expected to cost, assuming that you would want to get it into probably a higher level of court than the Ninth Circuit, and or than the federal court here in the state. That I would also be real interested in exploring with the EPA what their feeling is in terms of coming over and taking the TMDL issue over, because it appears to me that with the fiscal reality that's going on at the federal level, that may not anymore be their first course of action. So I think it would be interesting for the committee to have some kind of background, some kind of paper trail about what the nature of the discussions with EPA have been on the issue.
We can do that, Representative Morgan. I would stress that when EPA participated in the original litigation, their operating philosophy is they wanted the state to maintain primacy in terms of doing the TMDLs. The consent decree that they agreed with the plaintiffs on gave enough room for the state to try to get the job done so that they wouldn't have to immediately step in, because I think you're right, they don't want to do that in terms of their own resources. But right now, unless that consent decree was reopened, and renegotiated, they are legally bound to do the TMDLs for the state of Oregon.
But aren't there some issues on the federal level around non-point source regulation that have an impact on TMDLs in non-point source situations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, there have been numerous discussions over the last decade about the TMDL rule that drives all of this. The Clinton administration proposed a rule which was recently rescinded, actually about a week ago. The current EPA administration has been talking about developing a new rule for 2 years. It is not, my understanding is it may be at OMB. I don't know. It's not been released to the state or to the public, really, in terms of what the conclusion of their own rulemaking would be. So what that all means is currently we are operating under the TMDL rules that have been in effect since about 1992. But you're right, there have been a lot of deliberations about the whole TMDL program nationally.
Well, and it would seem to me that if there is the imminent arrival of a new rule for a non-point source, that we may be prudent to hold off spending more of the state's money until we know what that rule is and can work with it.
Chair Representative Morgan, given the history of EPA promulgating these rules, we could be waiting a long time. They've been talking about rules, again, almost for a decade. They withdrew this rule that took almost 5 years for them to put on the streets the first time, and there's no indication of when they're going to actually, if they even are going to be releasing a rule soon. I know there's a lot of debate about non-point sources in that context. But I can't tell you today what I think is going to be a very timely promulgation of a new federal rule.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think that in the budget situation that we find ourselves, where we're basically scraping every general fund dollar together that we can, that I would appreciate getting more information than I have on where this lawsuit's going and whether the money being spent on it is worth it, or whether we'd be better off to put the money into keeping old ladies in nursing homes or keeping prisoners in jails or something like that, because those really are the choices that we're faced with right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Morgan. You know, we're talking about authority and how much authority is at stake here. It would seem to me to be prudent, if that's in question to this point, that we should be cautious how hard and how fast we push forward. I would also be interested in if you could give us documentation on both the court actions here in Oregon as well as in California, so we can have a better feel for what are the issues. And I'm not sure we want volumes, but at least the summaries of what's going on and what the resolutions are.
Okay. We'd be glad to do that.
And Representative Johnson, you look like you have a question again.
No, sir.
Really? You fooled me this time. Okay, Michael.
Okay. Well, with that, we'll talk about Package 120. Hopefully the context now of this issue was established. Again, the legislature gave the EQ resources to accelerate the completion of TMDLs for the Willamette Basin for 9 of the 12 sub-basins in the Willamette. To get that job done by December 2003. We have been operating with limited duration positions to do that, and so what we're asking for is the final 6 months' worth of those limited duration positions to complete the TMDL by December of this year. Okay. The next package is also related to TMDLs. It's Package 122. Again, the legislature approved the establishment of 6 limited duration positions last session. This is federal funds to put into TMDL implementation. The issue here is that per this schedule, the staff that we had up until last session has been focused and remains focused on the development of the TMDLs. Once the TMDLs were done, one of the problems we faced is we didn't have the staff to help work with the watershed councils and the folks affected by the TMDL on implementation issues. EPA, actually Congress, increased the base grant to Oregon, all states, about 2 years ago, and we're using those funds and asked the states to put those funds into TMDL implementation, which is what we've done. So these folks, this is a request to convert these folks to permanent status rather than limited duration, because the funding source is now well established. It's not a ephemeral grant. It's built into our base grant. And from the effectiveness standpoint, we do have a lot of demand to help with the implementation of TMDLs once they're established. So this is what these folks would continue to do if we were to approve this package. Representative Morgan, you asked yesterday on the next package. This is the Drinking Water Protection Package 123. You noted that the funding source was other funds. The reason it is that's actually passed through from the Health Division. They manage the Safe Drinking Water Act, and they get federal funds to administer that act, and part of the Safe Drinking Water Act is called the Source Water Protection Program, which we co-manage with the folks from Health. This would be the last 2 years.
I appreciate that.
Okay. This would be the last 2 years of this project. Essentially, it's a technical assistance program where we go in and work with water suppliers and municipalities to, first of all, just to make it visible to them where does their drinking water come from. If you're in a surface water situation, we help establish the boundaries and the watersheds of where your water is coming from, identify vulnerabilities to your water supply source. If it's groundwater, we help them determine the groundwater recharge area that they get their drinking water supply from. And this has taken on extremely more significance, obviously, post 9/11, because there's a lot of concern now. So people understand their drinking water supplies, where they come from, the vulnerabilities of their water supply to pollution or other potential contamination sources. So this package would provide 5 positions that we currently have as limited duration, and we'll be done with the assessment and inventory work by the end of the next biennium. The next package is Package 124. It relates to the State Revolving Fund program that we've discussed a couple of times already. This package includes the establishment of a position to coordinate the overall policy work that we do in the SRF program, which is becoming more and more of a workload to us as this fund grows. As I think we mentioned, it's already up to about $45 to $50 million a year and growing. As we talked about yesterday with the proposed rule changes to establish eligibility for on-site systems or other types of activities beyond traditional municipal infrastructure, our workload and dealing with the external grantees or loanees is increasing quite a bit. This package also includes the authorization of the actual acceptance of the federal capitalization awards for the next biennium, which would be roughly $30 million more of federal money coming to the state of Oregon to provide for loans.
Yeah. Michael, I think I asked this question yesterday, and I'm not sure I got the total answer back, but what is the total amount of money we have out on loans at this point? This revolving fund.
Mr. Chair, let me get you a precise number on that. It's approximately $300 million. It's rotating through the system right now.
And we're adding about $45 million per year to that?
The federal government, the EPA through Congress, is capitalizing states at about $15 million. Our state, it's a formulaic amount that they divvy up the money. We get about $15 million a year that we have to match. So we're adding that much money each year.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How are those loans performing, and what mechanisms do you have to manage the loan portfolio?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we have staff in each of our regional offices who are basically project managers who work very closely with, in this case, it's primarily municipalities at this point, on helping them actually get the loans established, making sure that the project is built in a timely manner. EPA audits us every 2 years to make sure that the money's going where it's supposed to be, that the payments are coming back in. So it's a very, it's a highly managed program. We have received outstanding commendation from EPA since the establishment of this program in Oregon for our management, particularly our fiscal management of the program.
Comment, Mr. Chair. I'm very gratified to hear that because it had been my experience in observing some of the loan programs, particularly at Oregon Economic and Community Development, that they were not policed up, that in some cases the documents that loans and grants were made on were so sloppily drafted they were unenforceable. And it was just a concern to me that when you've got a loan portfolio in the $300 million range, knowing that it is performing and all terms and conditions are being met in a timely way just seems to me to be absolutely bedrock to that kind of program, and I'm delighted to hear that they're performing well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let me ask, how closely does the department supervise the construction of these revolving fund loans?
Mr. Chair, very closely, from a couple of angles. One is, first of all, any facility that is built in the state of Oregon, particularly for municipalities, publicly owned, goes through an extensive pre-planning process with us in terms of facility plans, where we look at make sure they're building the most cost-effective solution, meeting the water quality standards. So the worst-case scenario is that you spend millions of dollars building a treatment plant that doesn't meet the standards that you're aiming for. So we provide some value engineering insight and oversight to municipalities. For those who do get into the SRF program, because of the fiduciary responsibility we carry, we also make sure that what they say they're going to build to get the loan is actually built. So we do inspections of the actual construction. When they submit invoices and say they've just built a secondary clarifier, our folks go out and make sure that they built it according to the plan. So there's a tremendous amount of oversight. That's a double-edged sword. There are times where we do get pressure for not providing plan review, as we call it. Some people think that we shouldn't be overseeing, having engineers oversee other engineers. But at least with regard to the loan program, actually the federal law requires that level of oversight to make sure the money is well spent. And again, EPA audits us regularly, both on a program performance and the financial transactions.
So how often do you inspect? Are you on call so that when the contractor or the responsible local government needs an inspection, they call you, or do you show up on a certain schedule, or what I can envision is maybe construction at times needing to wait until someone can inspect. Is that?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that's the case. It's not a situation where maybe akin to like a building permit where we would go out with stop work orders or something like that. It's just more verification that they're on schedule to build the infrastructure and that they're, in particular from the SRF standpoint, it's making sure that they're building what we loaned them the money to build. So it's not a dynamic where, you know, we've got folks out there every day walking around the project. It's more check-in, particularly when we get the invoices that say something has been complete. Our folks will go out and make sure that it's been done.
I'm familiar with the Port Orford project that failed. How many failures have you had in this revolving loan fund? And I know in that case, it's my understanding that the community is still required to pay off the loan, even though it's out in the ocean. But have you had other failures?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware. When you say failure, you mean the project that was built and just didn't work?
Or left down, right? That case, but yeah, it didn't work.
A floating project, Mr. But, Chair?
Yeah.
And it floated away?
Mr. Chair,
it's gone. I don't know where it went.
I'm not sure that we have that many failures, but I'll certainly get back to the SRF staff.
It'd be interesting, because I think that would indicate maybe you need closer supervision of the project. Representative Krieger.
Stephanie, I talked to you earlier. Oh, it's been 6 months, a year ago, and you didn't have the TMDLs done for the coal keel. I guess you do now, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I believe what we did for the coal keel is accelerated the point source part of that TMDL so that those communities can move ahead.
Because they couldn't do the engineering.
That's right.
And size the plant, meet certain. They didn't know what they were shooting for, what the requirements were. I just wondered what the time frame was then. But in other words, once they understand what you need, and if they have the bonding, how long does it take for a small city like that to set a plan online that meets your specs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, often years, which is fine, because we actually build that into sometimes a mutual agreement and order, or the actual NPDES permit itself. It's not an immediate compliance issue. We take into consideration the time it takes for municipalities to do the planning, get the financing and the construction. So oftentimes we're talking a matter of years.
Representative, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to ask the question earlier, and I forgot, quite frankly. But I noticed that, according to this map, Goose Coquille system is 205-206. And it looks like on up the mid-coast that is in my district is, I believe that's 206 to 213. What's the implications of, what does that mean to the region? Does that mean it's more difficult to get permits, or does it have any impact on moving ahead, building systems, or?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does, and that's maybe one of the reasons why I'm concerned about delaying TMDL development, is it does have an economic impact upon doing it, in the sense if you have permits that are out of compliance today, with the water quality standards that are driving perhaps a listing on the 303D list, we cannot, by law, allow, with some exceptions, we cannot allow new or increased discharges to that same stream until the TMDL is done. So if you've got a municipality that's growing, you've got a new business that wants to come in and discharge to that stream, and we have not done the TMDLs, then there's no allowance to put that new or increased discharge into the stream. For some municipalities, it's exactly what Representative Krieger is talking about. They may have the need to upgrade their municipal treatment plant anyway. It may be through its life design. Obviously, from a public works director's standpoint, what you want to do if you're going to spend millions of dollars upgrading your treatment plant is you want to know all the parameters. You don't want to build it today and then 5 years from now have us come back in and say, well, that's great that you upgraded it today, but now here's a bunch of new numbers that are driven by the TMDL. So part of what we're trying to do is that delicate balance of how long can we wait to let a discharger continue with an expired permit or, you know, a facility that's basically not operational anymore until that TMDL gets done, because we're very sensitive to the fact that they want to build it right the first time and not have to reopen all the financing issues and ratepayer issues that come up when you invest in a municipal infrastructure. And the same for industries, too.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Krieger.
It's interesting because Port Orford ballot measure on their bonds to change their system went down by one vote. They had one vote. Ballot sent in blank. She forgot to check it. So now they're sitting there instead of getting, I forget how the system is, but something to do with the bonds now have to be completely paid by the city when they go through the system to the general election next year. Maybe you know about that, but it's a, they put, you know, they've made 25 years of mistakes as a city. Now they've compounded it. It's going to end up costing them again. They just don't seem to learn down there.
I would be interested in how many of these communities, I'm only familiar with the coast, I guess, but who are on some type of a moratorium at this point. And I'm thinking of Coos County, I'm thinking of Gold Beach, I'm thinking of Lakeside. I'm not familiar on up the coast, but my guess is a lot of them. And if they're on a moratorium now, what does that do if the TMDL is delayed as well?
We'll get that information for you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I think if you check, there's a, somewhere I was talking to an engineer, he's talking about delayed driving costs. Of course, right now interest is cheaper, but normally just construction costs, and that it's sizable just putting it off 2 or 3 years.
Okay. I'm now on page 28. Okay. The next policy package is package 129. You may recall from last session we asked for this package to create three positions or 2.5 FTEs to deal with the new, what is called Phase 2 stormwater regulations that EPA promulgated. The policy package included some general fund and some fees. The legislature approved the general fund component of the package, but not the fee part, and asked us to come back to the emergency board in September of last year, which we did. The issue was the regulations weren't in effect at the time, and we were being asked how many entities would be covered under this new federal regulation. The regulation, just to refresh your memories, this has to do with urban stormwater and construction erosion. It lowered the threshold, this is a national regulation, lowered the threshold of needing a permit for construction from 5 acres of disturbed land to 1 acre. And then it included a number of municipalities between the population of 10,000 and 100,000 into this phase two program. We obviously knew the municipalities were going to be brought in because that's just a census-driven calculation. But we weren't able to give a very definitive answer about how many new permits would we be dealing with in terms of construction erosion control permits from 1 acre to 5 acres. And frankly, that's still problematic because it's obviously driven by economic situation more than anything. But we did go back to the E-Board in September, and the E-Board did approve the increase in the limitation to accept the new fees coming in from these permits, which went into effect in December, but did not give us the position authority and told us just to use vacant positions, which we have been doing. So this package is, once again, to request that we actually get the position authority for the 2.5 FTEs that are we actually have on board today, but to have them from a position management, the actual positions associated with this function.
I have two questions. First of all, you mentioned, if I heard you right, the new rules take effect inside as city boundaries. But if I'm not mistaken, I've got a case going in my district right now, which is outside the city of Lakeside, but it is on the lake, in which they're required being asked to get a permit because went down to two acres, even though they were. It's less than five, so am I hearing, I'm confused whether this does only apply within the city limits or whether this two-acre limit now applies outside city limits as well.
Mr. Chair, it's actually a 1 to 5 acre. Before this regulation, it was any land disturbance of 5 acres or more needed a permit. The federal regs dropped that threshold now down to 1 acre or more. And it applies anywhere. It's not within municipal boundaries.
Okay, thank you. Second question.
we're dealing with the PERS issue right now and trying to figure out whether it's going to be Tier 2 or a whole new program or whatever. It would seem to me, I just want your reaction to this, and maybe Holly or someone is going to want to respond to this, but you've mentioned a couple of times that you wanted to permanent positions. I'm wondering if it would be prudent at this time, until we get the PERS issue settled in this session, whether we should be trying to put people into permanent positions. I'm just trying to think of the solvency of the PERS program.
Mr. Chair, I'll take a crack at it, and Stephanie. My personal reaction is that the packages that we are asking for, permanent positions, we've tried to tie to programs that we know are going to continue. They're not short-term, like the source water program as an example, which will go away. Or we'll be talking soon about the Lapine project, which will end this biennium. So for this stormwater program, that's going to be ongoing year in, year out, unless EPA obviously changes the regulation. So I think just philosophically it was hiring people and getting them trained so that they do this job every day, and they know that they're in a permanent position rather than trying to keep LDs running through limited duration positions was the basic philosophy of the request for at least these positions.
And it's on fees, not
on general. And that's right. It's a fee revenue.
Well, I'm not worried about the revenue to pay for the position. I'm worried about the cost to PERS. And it would seem to me to make a lot of sense right now to remain limited duration until maybe put that decision to the E-Board until we've worked through the session and figured out the PERS issue. Have you had any discussions amongst Stephanie or with DAS or anyone over there? Or maybe DAS has had some.
Well, I'm sure that Lisa would be happy to answer for herself, but we have not specifically discussed that issue. We have, I think, historically often when there is this kind of uncertainty, the legislature has given positions to the department on a limited duration basis rather than given them permanently for a variety of reasons, whatever the uncertainty may be.
Lisa, did you want to add to that?
Mr. Chair, I think that covers it.
Okay. Representative Krieger?
Just real quick, in package 129, there's two new positions.
It's three positions, 2.5 FTEs.
Okay, but it doesn't say it there, at least on the page I've got. Where do we connect up the package to the employees that are assigned to that package that might be new or part-time or something? They're not there. Where else is the connect at in the paper we've got?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, there's a summary of all these packages in Appendix A04, and then there's a more complete narrative description of all of these packages under Tab 6, which is the water quality tab in your binder.
Page
23. Here we go. Representative Krieger, you're referring to the stormwater package?
Yeah, well, any of the packages. Because if you look at the book we're going through now, you're talking about 2.5 new employees. But if I was to look at it 2 days from now, I wouldn't know how many new employees there is with that package unless I went somewhere else to find it.
Well, all of the packages, if you look under Appendix A04, that's a complete summary of all the packages that were presented to you. So that's one cross-reference.
And then under Tab 6... I'm looking at page 26, and then see it. Sure. Let me first ask Representative Krieger, did you have further questions?
No, I'm fine.
Mine is just a general question. This is other funds. And I sometimes get lost with other funds. So when we get one that's other funded, could you tell me where the money actually comes from? Because it could be a variety of things. I understand federal money and I understand general fund, but the other funds get a little complex.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, for this particular package I'm talking about, the Phase 2 program, is a wastewater permit that the applicant pays a fee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, first of all, to respond to Representative Krieger, the description of the policy package is on page 23 of tab 6, so there's a detailed description in the binder. So if you go to tab 6 for the water program and you go to page 23, you should see where it says package 129. And the organization of the binder is such that each program has a description of packages in it. But if that is too cumbersome for the dialogue we're going to have here, we'd be happy to create a summary that facilitates this discussion a little bit easier so you're not having to flip back and forth like this.
Well, and that is a problem because the FTE is on page 4, right? So we are having...
Okay. We'll do that.
Appreciate that. Okay, proceed, Michael.
Okay. The next package is package 125, which is on page 23 of the tab 6. This refers to the Environmental Monitoring Assessment Program, which is actually a monitoring program that's funded through federal funds. Again, like some of these other packages, this is the last 2 years of a program that's funded by EPA. Essentially, what this program is doing is providing more detailed monitoring data, both on water chemistry, but more importantly, it was filling in some of the gaps on the biological and physical health of some of the streams in our state. We're doing this in conjunction with several other states to provide just a better holistic look at what our water quality is in the state of Oregon. Mary Abrams, who's the division administrator for the laboratories here in the audience, she actually manages this program. But it gets into providing some of the benchmarks and metrics that we use to figure out, are we doing better? It relates to our water quality index. It relates to providing information of the Oregon plan on the health of streams pursuant to our desire to figure out whether streams are healthy for endangered fish, et cetera. So this is two positions. One of them would end at the end of 2004, and the other would end in 2005, and then the project is done.
Let me ask, as we're developing that data, realizing that we're not done yet, but are we finding that some of these streams do not meet the temperature standard even in their natural state?
Mr. Chair, yes, we certainly do. And some of the TMDLs that we've completed acknowledge that explicitly. And that's, I think, one of the benefits of the TMDL program, and the reason that we put so much resources into the analytical work is we know that this has always been an issue of trying to parse out what's a natural condition from what we've caused. And so the processes that we go through can come to closure on that, and we've acknowledged that explicitly in TMDLs.
And how do we document that if it is a partially inhabited area? There is some construction development on a stream, but a lot of it is still in the wooded areas. Or is there a model that you plug all this into to decide what the baseline is?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We use several types of models for our TMDL program, and we do use a lot of data, including you may recall the presentation we made in the interim on the FLIR technology, which provides us tremendous technical capacity now to try to look at the temperature profiles of streams. One of the projects that Mary's folks work on in the lab is looking at what we call reference areas, and these are areas that have, to our knowledge, no anthropogenic impact, and that's another way that we can look at an area that doesn't have anything going on and see what the temperature profile is there and then compare it to a stream next door that may have some activities, and that helps us parse this issue out of what's natural and what's man-caused.
And if a stream cannot meet the baseline, or the temperature standard, then what happens?
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, the temperature standard itself, which admittedly is confusing to everyone, the current temperature standard itself actually acknowledges that implicitly, that whatever the natural condition is becomes the actual standard for that particular water body. So let me give you an example. When we did, when we concluded the Grand Ronde TMDL, which is one of our first Oregon Plan TMDLs, after we looked at used all the modeling and we plugged in what we thought people could reasonably do in terms of riparian management and what the point sources could do, we concluded, at least based on modeling, that the lower end of the Grand Ronde system could not meet 64 degrees for a large part of the summer. That conclusion then feeds back to EPA when we submit our standards and we say for this part of the Grand Ronde River, 64 degree threshold is not applicable. It cannot be met. And then that hopefully closes the door on the issue with EPA and the services on what the temperature target is going to be for that particular water body.
But until we've done that, so I close this loop, until we've done the TMDL study, the temperature standard is 64 degrees. Is that
The standard, it's triggered by 64 degrees if the water body is above 64 degrees. It's also triggered by 55 degrees if it's a spawning habitat or 50 degrees if there's bull trout present. Yes, if those water bodies are above those thresholds, that's what triggers the TMDL. And the TMDL is the analytical process to figure out what is the actual thermal profile of that stream if we did reasonable management practices and point sources did their job.
I just can't avoid a comment here, Representative. If you bear with me, just take a second. But I think driven by EPA, I recognize that, but we went at it absolutely backwards. Because when we put that standard across the state, we absolutely put the state, the landowner base, at least, in shock. And it seemed to, I've always felt very strongly that had we gone in to pick certain basins that had especially strong interest and dealt with those and then worked back up to what was practical and what we could accomplish, would have saved your department and saved all of us an awful lot of grief. But water under the bridge at this point, so. Accept that. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, we just had the Biscuit fire, and Chetco coming out of the wilderness was 72 degrees. There's nothing up there. Never been touched. There was some mining back in 1940 for chrome in a couple spots, but other than that, there's no entry, no roads. So that is one of those instances that Senator Mesley is talking about. Natural condition. Well, I think if you were to go in parts of the Illinois, Winchup, Chetco, Pistol River, that fire denuded right down to the creeks, all the riparian vegetation, the duff is gone, everything. I would suspect that you're going to see higher temperatures in those areas, not only this next summer than historically that we were able to measure, but probably for a good number of years into the future. Part of that's in the Kaminopsis wilderness, which means if the Forest Service does what it normally does, which is collect their wages and let it burn, and they're not going to do anything, for the most part, you're not going to see anything come back in there that's going to help reduce that. How are the people downstream of that on the private property? Now, they're going to be saddled with this temperature thing that's for God knows how long. How do you... That is actually a natural condition. If you consider the fire as a natural happening, the environmental community might say that's good. Well, then it must be good that the results of the fire, which is higher temperatures, is good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's an excellent question that we have not answered, obviously because of the precedent of that fire. My gut reaction to it is that we would need to look at that as a natural condition in terms of what the actual temperatures in the stream are. One of the benefits, though, of having the models that we do is we could take a look at once the hypothetical vegetation regrows in that area, what would the temperature look like given that data? And we can try to take that into account. But we have not really tackled something as catastrophic as those fires in terms of the temperature standard. Other than, again, my gut reaction is that to me is a pretty clear natural condition in terms of what's happened there.
But it looks like that area is being worked on
right now. Let me expand on that a little bit, because it's not just temperature. I would think we would also be concerned with sediments and chemicals and, from the ash and everything else that's going to wash out. And let me just ask you, is the department taking advantage of the event we had last summer to do some good sampling, good monitoring on what impact that event is doing to the water quality?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the specific. I'll find out what we're doing. Stephanie just mentioned that looking at the schedule, we're probably right in the middle of the data collection on those watersheds given the sequence. So let me get back to you on that. I think that's...
And we have other basins throughout the state that have had the same type of
right.
event. So
definitely makes their job harder and more complex because you threw another variable in there that we don't know.
Thank you.
Okay. The next package is package 143. Again, this is the final 2 years of a project in the Lapine area. It's actually a national demonstration project that EPA funded. This is looking at alternative technologies primarily for treatment on on-site systems. We have about 16 innovative treatment systems in the Lapine area that are in the ground today on about 50 pieces of property. We are looking at the ability of those technologies to treat primarily nitrogen, given the concern in the Lapine area with the shallow groundwater and a lot of lots that are next to each other. This is a project that's getting a lot of national attention in terms of very good analytical work, and hopefully, as we discussed yesterday, Mr. Chair, that one of the benefits of having the project here in Oregon is we'll be able to approve the technologies that go through that system and get them into the marketplace here in Oregon. I just talked to our coordinator this morning, and she's saying that some of the technologies are just proving to be outstanding in terms of their performance. So we're very excited about this. And I think you will see a greater market share of technologies in the next couple of years. So this package is to fund 5.5 FTEs to complete the Lapine project by the end of the budget. And again, they'd be limited duration positions.
Let me ask. I would assume we're monitoring the groundwater to see if this had an impact on the quality of the groundwater.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Extensive monitoring going on with the cooperation of homeowners, Deschutes County. A lot of data is being generated in this project in terms of background groundwater, as well as how these systems are actually performing in terms of their effluent quality.
Have we been at it long enough to see any change?
Well, Mr. Chair, not in terms of what's going to change in the groundwater, because I just talked to the project coordinator today, and one of the conclusions they've already found with the modeling is that the groundwater moves extremely slow in the Lapine area, which I guess was a surprise to some of the hydrogeologists who thought it moved quicker. People are drinking water that's probably about 40 years old, so they're not dealing yet with the, and that's the deeper wells. But the problem is the contaminated area on the surface is starting to migrate down, so one of the things the model will do is determine if they have status quo there in terms of development, the depth of the wells, and they don't change the nature of their treatment systems, how soon is it going to be before people are drinking highly contaminated groundwater? We're talking nitrates in the order of 40 to 50 milligrams per liter, which is way, way above the health standard. So I think it's a win-win in the long run here, because these technologies that are focused on nitrate treatment are like 2 milligrams per liter coming out of the system, which is extraordinary. And they're expensive systems in one sense. They're $12,000 to $13,000 for some of them, but a sewer hookup for some of these lots would be $20,000. So it's looking as though these technologies will help the situation avoid the more expensive option of sewering.
I have to say, 40 years old isn't so bad. Do you agree, Representative Krieger? Secondly, it makes me kind of smile. I hope I haven't shown it too much, but my wife and I were taking a mailboat trip up the Rogue River a few years ago, and the mailboat operator pulled the boat around in front of this big rock cliff, and he said that those rocks up there who happen to have seagull poop on them, so they look all white and gray, and he said those are some of the oldest rocks in the world. And the tourist just oohed and awed, and I said, the oldest rocks in the world. Isn't that an interesting way to phrase it? But it made me think the same thing about water. Some of the oldest water in the world is other. Okay. I'm having fun here.
I know.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the final package is package 180. And this is, I think Lisa discussed this the other day, this is a transference of the oversight and management of, not the oversight, I'm sorry, but the administrative coordination of the Lower Columbia Estuary Program to OEB from DEQ.
And that will use federal or ballot measure 66?
It's a combination of general fund and lottery.
Whatever we get.
Whatever we can find. Okay.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions of Michael?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask Dick Peterson to come up now to start the overview of the land quality policy packages that are on page 29. And I believe he's also, as the other administrators did, going to give you a brief overview of the programs in land quality before he talks about the two packages that they have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Administrator of the Land Quality Division for DEQ. And as Stephanie said, I will be giving you a very brief overview of the land quality activities in the land quality program, and then I'll talk about the two option packages on page 29. And my overview is going to be very brief. Land quality, there's a lot of information on land quality behind tab 7 in your book, so there's certainly a lot of information there you can refer to. I'm just going to talk about the different activities and highlight some of the things that are going on in those areas that may be of interest to you. I'm first going to talk about emergency response, and we talked a little bit about that when we first got started. And I would say that DEQ is probably better prepared to respond and more efficient in terms of response than we've ever been before. And there's a lot of reasons for that. A lot of it has to do with historic activities, including New Carissa 9/11. But I will tell you that, in my view, that having field-placed, highly trained staff being available to respond to spills and emergency is really where the bread and butter of this program is. That allows us to respond in some fashion to the 2,000-plus calls that we might get a year. And certainly in preparation, working with vessel traffic going up and down the coast and in the Columbia has been really critical in being prepared to respond to those kinds of emergencies and accidents. Moving on, the solid waste program is another activity within land quality, and we primarily permit and monitor landfills, transfer stations around the state. And managing solid waste has certainly been something that the state has worked on for a very long time, and we continue to do so. As you, I'm sure you know, that the active landfills in the state are shrinking, and more transfer station moving garbage and waste to landfills is growing. Well, Oregon and the legislature and certainly DEQ has risen to the occasion and really pushed in terms of recycling and use of materials so that we don't continue to grow our landfills, if you will. And that's a benchmark for us, and we are meeting that benchmark in terms of reduced number of pounds of solid waste that's going to landfills per capita. And certainly the reuse and recycling activities are really expanding and growing in terms of opportunities. One example certainly is composting. The composting industry is growing. We have 34 commercial composters in the state that we monitor, and so that's a big reason why a lot of that material is going back to really good productive reuse rather than ending up in landfills. Moving on, hazardous waste is another activity within the land quality program, and this program is delegated from the federal agency under the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, and it is a very mature program. It was delegated back in 1986 to the state of Oregon, and the level of sophistication in Oregon for this program is really high. We have very good collaborative work with the stakeholders and regulated industry, and certainly have a good viable program in Oregon. Several years ago, the legislature, working with stakeholders and DEQ, shifted some of our work in the hazardous waste arena to business assistance, whereby we help go out and help people, generators of hazardous waste, to comply with these complex regulations, work with them on how to reduce the handling of hazardous waste, and really help keep hazardous waste from going into an area that might end up in environmental cleanup, which can be very expensive. And that's been very successful. And we'll talk a little bit later about hazardous waste and one of the option packages that we're dealing with here and with the stakeholders later on. Shifting again to tanks, underground storage tanks.
That's, I think on Monday we talked about, that's a program that on a federal perspective has really transcended to something that's new and different for the state, and that is that underground storage tanks are needing to be have operational licenses for having underground storage tanks. And in Oregon, we've responded to that very well. I mean, I think over 95 or somewhere around 98% of all underground storage tanks are currently operating with a permit, which is required by the federal law. We are in transition in that work, in underground storage tanks work. So now everybody is certified to operate, and now we're working with tank owners on sort of the compliance and meeting all the conditions of owning those tanks, and working with stakeholders, working on training, helping people out and that sort of thing. And that's kind of the shift of the tank program now. And per the last legislative directive, is we are going to EPA to get that program authorized to the state of Oregon, which is very which is really supported by the stakeholders in the tank industry for sure.
What percentage of abandoned tanks now have been removed?
Mr. Chair,
I
don't have that number, but we can certainly get it to you.
That's been a big focus for the last several years, hasn't it? Be interested in how far along we are.
Yeah, we can get those numbers to you for sure. The next activity that I just wanted to mention in the land quality program is environmental cleanup. And we had mentioned on early on in the week about the environmental cleanup law that was established in 1995. And I would say that over the course of the years that we've made some major adjustments in the implementation of that environmental cleanup law. And those adjustments have been necessary because of the sort of changing or the scope of the types of sites that we might be dealing with in that arena. They range from, say, a small underground storage tank that might have a little bit of soil contamination to something as big and complex as Portland Harbor, that is now a Superfund site. So we've created a multifaceted approach, and we range from enforcement sites where we actually order people to clean up, moving into a voluntary cleanup program, which we work collaboratively with parties, and the voluntary cleanup program itself was really a model for the nation when it was first worked on in Oregon. Something a little bit new is the independent cleanup pathway, whereby a company can work with us at however they want. In other words, if they want to just bring a document for us to review, they will say, all we want you to do, DEQ, is review this document. We'll give them a period of time that we have to turn that review around, and so they come and access us that way rather than going from beginning to end through that process. And that, in my view, is one of those new programs that is really working. We have an orphan site program whereby if there's contaminated sites that we don't know who the owner is or they're unwilling or unable to pay, that we can tap those orphan funds to go out and work on these high-priority sites and protect human health and the environment. And for those sites where we just can't get people to cooperate and work with us, where we use orphan site money, we aggressively pursue cost recovery on those. One thing that you mentioned, Mr. Chair, was a prospective purchaser agreement, which I think is another really good tool that DEQ has had, whereby purchases of property that are contaminated can their liability can be defined, and they can be certain. So when they're walking in to buy a piece of property, they know what their cleanup liability would be. And that's been very useful and used a lot. And finally, in environmental cleanup, I was just going to mention brownfields. That's certainly the new term that's being used and we're working on not only nationally but in Oregon, whereby we work really closely with communities and industries who want to reuse and redevelop property that is contaminated rather than expand out into uncontaminated areas, where we aggressively work with people to clean up those properties. And money comes to us from EPA to work on that program. And again, Oregon is really a good model for that. And just a demonstration of that is there's a National Brownfields Conference every year, and they've chose Oregon as to host next year's National Brownfields Conference next fall, and it draws somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 people. So again, that's the new sort of look at cleaning up contaminated properties. Then finally, for land quality, I just wanted to mention another thing that we work on in the program is what I'll call multimedia kind of high-profile issues for DEQ, where multimedia, I mean air, water, land, the environmental media, and we try to coordinate and center our activities across those media so that we're working together. The three issues that we're working on right now are toxics, more focused on mercury right now, and our response to that, abandoned mines and sediments. And so those are the three things that we're working on in a cross-program way in land quality. So with that, that's my overview of the land quality program, pretty high level. Like I said, lots of information in behind tab 7 on basic elements of those.
If there's any questions of the committee at this point? I have a couple, Peterson. In your first opening remarks about response teams, mm-hmm. It's been an interest in my district. The requirements for ships coming into Newport. Where they're research vessels. It's been a while since they've had a ship in there, but they are required to have the equipment and the personnel dockside, I believe it was anyway, as long as the ship was there. They're also, I don't know if this is Coast Guard, I guess, but they're required to have a bar pilot. And the net effect of this is that many of those research vessels go to Astoria, and then they put the personnel and the data in a van and ship it to, and haul them to Newport. Hmm. Are we seeing any, and I don't know if this is a rule or statute or what, but have you been approached with that? I know I raised a question with someone here a year or two ago.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as far as bar pilots, I haven't been approached at all.
I think that's Coast Guard, but I'm mainly talking about the response, the requirements of a response team.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that the department did over the course of the last year or so is we modified our rules that do couple of things, and I don't know if this really gets at the response team question, but and this again is working with stakeholders and really implementing what the legislature wanted us to do, is to define what the roles in terms of response are and equipment that needs to be in geographic areas. And I just don't remember specifically if the rules themselves identify exactly what response teams need to be, but I can get that back to you for sure.
I would appreciate that, because mm-hmm. as I understood it, because they had a certain number of gallons of fuel on board,
right.
It kicked them into that category, even though they had bow thrusters and everything else. I mean, there was no really danger of very low risk, I guess, of having an accident.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we'll check that out for you.
I appreciate that. Yeah. The other one, how far back do you document old landfill sites? And do you have I think, Stephanie, you gave us something for 10 years or something like that, but I know there's sites that go back much, much farther than that. And I'm familiar with a few sites that were owned by the city that, you know, went back 30, 40 years, but they were never totally covered or cleaned up. Everyone kind of forgot about them. And you have to wonder where there's barrels and cans and buckets and those kind of things, the lasting impact that those could have.
Mr. Chair, we'll get back to you on that, too. I know the list that we provided yesterday is certainly understanding of closed landfills, and I'm just not familiar with how far back they went, but I'll check that out for you.
I think that's all I have.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, page 29 is the packages that I'll be talking about. There's two of them. The first one is package 131, which what this package does is restore 8.37 positions to the hazardous waste program. And just a very brief background is we've over the past several years we've seen reduced fees coming from the Arlington landfill, and this has primarily been due to loss of volume of material that's been going to the landfill, and one of the biggest volumes that's been reduced is potliner from aluminum smelters, and we're not going to see a rebound in that. So we've lost that revenue, and also another revenue that's been flat is since 1997 is fees on hazardous waste generators, and so the money that was the fees that were established in 1997 bought a certain amount, and they don't buy the same amount now, is basically what's happened. So this package is looking at restoring 8.37 positions, and we got together with a work group that working with the industry, trying to figure out how do we best work on this program and get revenues back. Yes,
Mr. Chairman, this in tab 7. Page 30 of the land quality section is where this package is described.
So the work group worked with us on how do we best fund this need here, and several things came up, and one of those was through billing efficiencies we can generate dollars to pay for these positions, and those billing efficiencies are electronically built, electronic billing that actually we mentioned earlier. And the other funding source for this is a fee increase. And this fee increase is at about 22%, and what it reflects is the cost of living increase that we would have seen from 1997 until a new bill would go out. And there is one other little fee that's in there, and that's a $200 fee to get a hazardous waste ID number. And this 22% in particular in the hazardous waste ID number was agreed to with the industry that were on our committee working with us, and they would support the 22% fee increase, and that's what we're bringing forward.
If I could break in here, let me clarify. As I look at A4 under package 131, mm-hmm. It's got five positions and 8.37 FTE. Is that number backwards from what it should be?
Four.
It's at 8.37 positions. It says five positions.
That number refers to this position.
What is the position column on this column? What does this mean? What does this position mean?
It's a number of positions.
So.
Did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's probably due to parts of positions being phased out because of not enough revenue to support the position. So let's say that the department could support a half of an FTE in the position, but then this new revenue would pay for the other half of the position. So the position itself is already existing. They're just adding FTE to that position.
That's right.
Okay, and forgive me. Because I think I was looking through the book trying to figure this out when maybe you already covered this, but if you're losing material in the landfill, and has this landfill, again, justify for me the need for more FTE.
Actually, Mr. Chair, the landfill gets hazardous waste not only from Oregon but from out of state, and we collect fees from that. The volume of hazardous waste generators has remained fairly steady. There's 200 what we call large quantity generators. There's about 400 small quantity generators, and then there's about 3,000 what we call conditionally exempt generators. And so we're not seeing a reduce in the number of generators in requiring the work in terms of permitting and business assistance, that sort of thing. It's just the revenue that comes from Arlington from different sources that has gone down.
Okay.
Mr.
Kelly, Senator Dukes.
And help me with the money again. There's a fee increase. How much of this $1.5 million is the fee increase?
The breakdown for this is the fee increase of 22% would generate $493,000 for the biennium, 0305.
And the other is what money?
A billing efficiency whereby we're going to get another billing cycle through electronic billing in the next biennium would generate $1.3 million.
So you're going to bill them earlier?
Actually, there'll be three billing cycles in 0305 rather than two.
Oh, that's short-term, I assume,
yes, it is.
Money. I mean,
right.
We speed it up a little bit, we get the money sooner, we don't get it later. Does that cause us a problem later?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, yes. It's a problem that the industry is well aware of, and the industry, along with us and others, are going to go back and look at if there's other options to make up the money, more efficiencies and that sort of thing.
Okay. It just seems like you're setting yourself up for a problem in the next biennium. How much are we getting out of this billing efficiencies?
$1.3
million. It just seems a little problematic, but I guess everything we do now is short term, right?
Mr. Chair, continuing along this, one of the things that I want to bring up is maintaining delegation for the hazard waste program is critically important, not only to, I think, to us, but also to the industries that are regulated. And I mean, we've looked at efficiencies in this program for a long time, and over the years we've gone from 61 FTE down to 45, and EPA is starting to get a little worried about whether we can fulfill our end of this. And I think maybe one of the things that we're certainly working with is working with EPA to see how we can cooperate in terms of our business assistance side so they could recognize that as fulfilling some of the needs in terms of a delegated program.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
could you put some of this in English?
Sure.
Maintaining delegation, meaning that they let us run it?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it's a federal program that's been delegated to the state of Oregon, and so we've been authorized or delegated to run the hazardous waste program.
And you have a feel for how low we can go before they... Sounds like they're sniffing around.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that's a very good question. And, in fact, I was going to get to Senate Bill 196, which is another part of this, but I'll answer your question now. It's one of the things in Senate Bill 196, which we support, is that DEQ and industry and EPA sit down together to try to firmly establish what the bar is or the minimum for keeping a delegated program.
You need a law for that?
Pardon?
You need a law for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't believe we need a law for that.
Okay. But you got a Senate bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, Senate Bill 196 is a bill that authorizes us to increase fees that are proposed here. There's another element of that that's not part of this, but it's also to divert enforcement dollars to the program, but it's not part of this package, but that's in Senate Bill 196 that's being worked on in the committee.
Mr. Chair, if I could just inject something here that might help. Basically, some time ago, the hazardous waste program figured out they were going to have a serious funding shortfall because the waste volumes were down at Arlington. And so that funding shortfall could, in fact, put delegation of the federal program to DEQ at jeopardy. And as you heard in my testimony, the stakeholders in the state prefer generally that we do the regulatory programs as opposed to EPA doing them. So we at that time, a year and a half ago, I think, convened this stakeholder advisory committee to address this looming funding shortfall. And Senate Bill 196 is a product of the work of that advisory committee that basically puts together some disparate components for funding this program. One of the components is, in fact, an increase on the tip fee at Arlington. Another component is adding an additional billing cycle. Another component is the $200 registration fee that Dick referred to. Another component is a referral of general fund penalty money that would normally go into the general fund back to the agency to pay for business assistance. So through the work, it's not uncommon in all of the fee setting that we do at the department. We always need to work with the stakeholders because, as I don't have to tell you, it's not going to go anywhere unless we have stakeholder mm-hmm. support. So it is not uncommon that when you have a dialogue like that, you'll come out with sort of a package, if you will. And that's why it came to be. And probably, as you correctly noted, Senator Dukes, will need to get looked at again when the 1.3 one-time fix of the billing cycle is not there anymore.
I want to come back to something else I thought I heard you say, that the feds do not recognize state expenditure working with the generators to reduce the load. Can you tell me what's behind that? That seems like a natural. One of the easiest ways to fix the problem is to reduce the load.
I would agree with your last statement for sure. The federal program is about enforcement and compliance. It's about doing inspections, noting violations, and taking action to correct those violations. Business assistance is about working with individuals, about understanding the regulations, seeing some things they could do a little bit different, and helping them out. It's not inspection, compliance, enforcement sort of thing. And EPA, they're nervous, I guess, about how we can fulfill the inspection, compliance, enforcement component of it by doing this kind of business assistance. We think it's a strong program, business assistance. We think we get a lot of gains, and we think we can work with EPA to help them understand the value of that.
It's a mindset, isn't it? You solve the problem by carrying a big stick as opposed to working with people. Had to say that.
Okay. Moving on, the second package is on page 31 under tab 7, the detail. It's package 136 for Umatilla Environmental Compliance. And it is to hire an environmental compliance inspector to work very specifically at the Umatilla facility as the incinerators start working, and to hire for 6 months an environmental law specialist to make sure that we're working with the folks out there on the compliance issues and being able to enforce and work with that. And DQ has a strong history of involvement out there and an expectation that we'll stay involved. The funding from this is from the Department of Defense through a memorandum of agreement.
Okay, that does it. Any questions, committee? Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to our presentation, we have three more pieces to the package. I'd like to ask Helen Lafferty to join me at the table, and she's going to cover the cross-media and agency management program and policy packages. Then I'm going to talk about a couple of things today or tomorrow with you, and then go into some of the questions I think the co-chairs had that you'd like a response to, and that's what we have planned for the rest of our hearing with you, just so you know.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Helen Lotridge. I'm the Administrator of the Management Services Division at DEQ, and I'm going to give you a very brief overview of what agency management is and does. Agency management is the part of our budget that includes the Office of the Director and her staff, and the Management Services Division, which I administer. Within Management Services, there is accounting, budget, information management, human resources, and health and safety. So our major responsibilities are to keep the agency in compliance with legal and ethical requirements, and to provide service and support to all of the other programs at DEQ. So these are all central services that benefit everyone, and so the way that they're paid for is that everyone contributes through a surcharge, and that's one of those other funds that we have, Senator Dukes. The contribution is calculated on direct labor costs, and so that's how we're funded. My major focus during the last year has been on the information management part of my division, and this was partially, at least, in response to a budget note from this committee during the 2001 session that directed us to investigate whether we could gain efficiencies in information management by centralizing all of it within the Management Services Division. So we undertook a very rigorous analysis of all of our information management and looked at our broad range of options that we might have. And I'm just going to name two major findings for you here and can give you more detail if you wish. The first is that our information management investment at DEQ for 0305, assuming the governor's balanced budget, is just slightly less than what we were able to invest in 1995 and 97. So we've remained about level, have declined just slightly in what we spend on that. At the same time, we were able to accomplish several major service improvements, and at the same time, the average age of our computer systems increased from about 5 years to about 7.5 years. I'll say more about that in a minute because it's a problem. The second major thing that we learned in this analysis project was that we still have considerable room for improved efficiency and effectiveness in our information management. We believe not through further centralization, but rather through more collaboration and cross-program prioritization so that we're utilizing the resources that we already have in the best way possible and toward agency priorities.
Helen, it's at tab AM2 if they want to refer to that.
Yes, thank you. The full report is under tab AM2 if you wish to read that. Before I go into the policy packages, I want to just touch on one more area of the Management Services Division, and that's our accounting office. We have a very good outcome on our audits, and we're very, very pleased with that, particularly in this particular time. We have very rigorous standards at DEQ as far as compliance with legal and ethical requirements are concerned. And I just want to toot the horn for the accounting office. Yes.
Representative Johnson.
I'm just curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You keep saying ethical.
Yes.
Give me an example.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we are extremely rigorous in how we spend the public's money, and we go quite beyond the legal requirements of how we need to invest that money and take our job very seriously as public servants. So we're very, very conservative in how we spend our money and how we comply with the generally accepted accounting principles. We go farther than we need to in that regard. And that's what I'm referring to.
Thank you.
I hope that answered your question. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to mention that our accounting office received the Controller's Gold Star Award for the 15th year in a row this year. And it's not unusual for an agency to get that award, but it is pretty unusual to get it for 15 years in a row. So I'm very proud of them for that, and I wanted to mention it to you. Okay, turning to the policy packages, which are on page 30
of my handout,
of Stephanie's handout, and under tabs 8 and 9 in your binder. Package 151, which is under tab 8, page 11, would allow us to continue the work that we began with a federal grant that was approved by the e-board last fall. This federal grant was for about $640,000, and we have about $363,000 left in that grant work to do, and that's 1.5 FTE, which is three positions, and those are limited duration positions. And we would finish up that grant work in the 0305 biennium. That's all federal money. There's no match required for that. Package 152 which is also in tab 8, page 11, is requesting an additional FTE, one employee, in the Pollution Control Tax Credits Program. The volume in that program has more than doubled within the last few years, and we cannot handle the volume with the current staff of one, and so we're asking to bring in another FTE for that program. It will require no fee increase. The increase in volume and those fees will cover the cost of this FTE.
Mr. Chair, I'm not even sure what to ask. I'm confused all of a sudden.
The increase in volume will cover the amount? This is a tax credit. This is money going out the door. How does...
Yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, let me try to be more clear. Okay. The volume of applications has increased, and those are applications that need to be processed within DEQ and reviewed. And so that's each one of those applications is a unit of work for us, and those have about doubled in the last couple of years, and we can't keep up with the processing of them anymore with just one person.
And I understand that, but I thought you'd indicated that the increase in volume was somehow going to pay for this.
Oh, yes. There is a fee for applying for a tax credit.
Oh,
so the applicants for the tax credit pay a fee.
I didn't realize.
To do that, and that fee covers the cost of administering the program, covers 100% of the cost of administering the program.
Okay. Is there any way that you can give us a breakdown on the increase? We have this debate in this building every once in a while between on the pollution control tax credits as to how much is what we're giving credit for that's required by state law, and what we're giving credit for to encourage people to go above and beyond. Is there any way to get a breakdown on that? I'd like to see as we're increasing. I mean, it sounds like it's increased a lot. Are we getting people just a lot more creative and they're doing a lot better things, or do we have a lot more people who figured out they can get a credit to comply with the law?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, those are good questions. We do have a breakdown on the tax credits. I don't have it with me, and I don't know whether Holly does today, but we can get that to you. We issue a report every year on that, and we'd be very happy to provide it.
But does it break it down in terms of what's required and what isn't required?
Yes, it does.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The increase... There are a number of reasons for the increase, but probably the major one is because of the availability now of tax credits for non-point source pollution control facilities, and that increased them quite a bit.
Okay, but we've also increased then the regulation on non-point source pollution as well. So, but I
would like the program administrator speak to that.
Okay,
but I don't give you wrong information, sir.
Okay.
Okay, on package 165, which is under tab 9, page 12, these are continuations and restorations. It's not new work. We're asking to restore two positions of five that were reduced in our current service level budget. This amounts to 1.5 FTE. Those 1.5 TE, one of them is a budget analyst, and the other, the half, is our bonds officer. As you know from looking at our budget, we have quite a bit of bond activity and requirement to manage those, and so we're asking for half of a position to take care of that. The remainder is we ask to restore some contract money, and we will spend that on customer service activities, and actually the bulk of it would go to bringing our obsolete information systems more current. The average age of our systems is increasing, and therefore our maintenance costs are also increasing, and that money is critical for us to avoid having to use spare parts and support systems that are no longer supported by the vendors.
Mr. Chair. The other funds are what kind of money?
That is, that is again the indirect surcharge for the central services. So.
Oh, okay. So you're charging everybody else within the agency, and
that's right.
So we're recycling the general fund.
Some
or
of
the
it,
fees, or the
some of it comes right.
Okay, thank you.
Package 167 requests a one-half of one limited duration position to be our facilities coordinator. We find that it's much more cost-effective to manage our facilities needs centrally, and that relieves our field staff of having to do this office by office by office. So this includes our leases and any other issues that are raised by our various office locations.
Okay. Questions, committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get a sense of how much redundancy there is here, because we had Das sitting at the same table where you are, talking about their unified mission to take care of properties and be the repository for all the information about state facilities. Explain to me how this isn't a redundancy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the DAS folks do the bulk of the work, by far the largest bulk of it. They need to coordinate with someone in the agencies as they're doing that work in order to know what our needs are and to discuss various options with us and our funding requirements. And so what we have found is that it's much more efficient for them to have one point of contact than it is for them to contact managers in every office across the state, who then have to familiarize themselves with the issues.
How serious would it be if this didn't happen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, it would be less efficient, and we would continue to absorb that function in our field offices. Thank you.
Senator Meserle and Representative Johnson, I would just add, if you would like, we could give you some kind of an estimate of that cost, because the fact of the matter is without this function, we would have, for example, a regional administrator who's in the Pendleton office negotiating leases through DAS with the owner of the building. Same might be true in Eugene. Same might be true in Salem. Same might be true in Medford. So there, you know, we've requested this because we've had the experience of doing it that way, and it takes a fair amount of time of some fairly high-priced help at DEQ to do that, and I'd be happy to provide that to you if it's helpful.
Hello. I'm sorry to be so dense about this, but you pay a fee, an agency fee to DAS.
That's correct.
To do this kind of stuff for you. Are you not getting good service from DAS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, let me quickly say that we are getting good service from DAS on the facilities management. It's excellent service that we're getting from DAS. It's just that they can't perform their facilities work for us in a vacuum without any information or input from us. And so there's quite a bit of interaction that goes back and forth, and that's what this is about.
May I give an example, Senator Meserle, without beating this to death? But we've just gone through, and you're going to hear about this in a few minutes from me, quite an extensive discussion about the need to relocate our laboratory. And we actually had a person from DEQ on special assignment to just deal with this issue, which involved DAS and a variety of players, Portland State. If we had not dedicated a staff person, took them away from doing other things just to work on this, then the administrator of our laboratory, Dr. Mary Abrams, would have been spending her time working with DAS and everybody else, putting all the pieces together. So we do have 18 field offices, plus a headquarters and a laboratory, the vehicle inspection stations. There are a lot of issues around facilities, and DAS does do a good job serving us, but they do have to have a place to come to within our agency to get information.
Before the horse falls over dead, I'm going to quit.
I'll carry on for you. because I can envision
an added step in here. There's some situations I would think that, you know, if there's a problem with a landlord, that DAS has to go get information from the people on the ground. And so I'm not clear to me how you can step across that by a centrally located office.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Helen could bail me out here. One point I do want to make is, first of all, we are in leased space. We don't own any facilities. So there's a lot of discussions that go on in terms of just renegotiating leases that we're involved in anyway. So we don't really feel like we're adding any. It's the fact is that someone somewhere at DEQ is going to have to get involved in facilities issues at some point when they come up, whether it's negotiating a lease or some kind of problem with the HVAC or whatever it is. And what we're trying to do, rather than have our program managers who are supposed to be working on environmental stuff do that, we're trying to centralize that work in this position so they can handle all of that stuff for all of our offices, working with DAS and the lease landlords and whoever.
But you're still working very closely with the people in the locations as well.
I mean, absolutely. That's, yeah.
So you're not totally taking that responsibility away.
You can't. That's correct.
I heard a gas pool.
Yeah, you did. This is a permanent halftime position for full benefits and all those kinds of things.
We've asked for it as limited duration.
Okay, so it may not be permanent, but it's still with. I tell you, point blank, you probably ought to give up on this one. I'll go up the hill with you on TMDLs and services to Oregonians. I don't think I'm going up the hill for half a position. For this, I know that makes more stress on the agency, but life is tough right now. So, I understand what you're telling me, and I understand it's going to take time, and it's taking time from very high paid people, and this would probably be a lower paid people. But this, I assume, is coming from those same internal charges, and ultimately, right. Those internal charges, when we get them high enough, result in higher fees or something someplace, or the need for a bigger federal. Contribution or something, and so this just may not be the right biennium to do that.
Representative Johnson's got her second win.
But the horse is on the ground.
The horse just staggered back to life. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what Senator Dukes is saying on behalf of at least two of us is don't waste a lot of time researching this for tomorrow.
Thank you. I appreciate your feedback.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Sure.
If I may, I've just been handed an answer to an earlier question that we received on the tax credits, and that is on the the applications. No, this is the number of dollars certified, or the dollar sign or number sign. Of the number of dollars of tax liability that we certify, 76% of those dollars are because required facilities have been installed, and 24% is for above and beyond.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have you completed your
presentation? I have.
Good. Any other questions? Stephanie, our time is up. We've got actually 1 minute. Would you mind holding your summary until tomorrow?
I wouldn't mind at all, Mr. Chairman, and I ought to be able to complete that summary in just a few minutes tomorrow, and we can move on to the co-chair's questions or whatever else you may have.
Sounds good.
It'll allow the horse to rest.
That's right.
With that, we'll close the public hearing and adjourn the committee.